Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm making my grandfather Vertuca's spaghetti and meatballs in Parkridge, Illinois. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven. Great to be here with you today. This is show number 841. And what we do here on this show is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN radio studio today. So good morning to Mr. Ferguson. Happy Thanksgiving to Bob. And hey, happy Thanksgiving to you listening to this show right now. This weekend, it's kind of like recovery. And you bust open the fridge and you get the leftovers. I love leftovers. Big fan. Turkey, you know, I could take it or leave it. We talked about this last week. Mashed potatoes and gravy, sign me up all day. So hopefully you're working on some leftovers that are delicious from the big meal this week. And we have a lot to do on the show. One of the best places to see music in Chicago, The Hideout, over on Wabansia in the Westtown area, is closed for the rest of the year. So there is some controversy around what's going on over at The Hideout. We will talk to a journalist who is kind of, part of the controversy a little bit. So stay tuned for that. Also, hey, yesterday, the new Bourbon County Stout line was released from Goose Island, and it's always a big deal every year. We will talk to Josh Noel. He writes for the Tribune, and he writes all about the local beer scene. He's got some reviews about this year's batch of Bourbon County Stout. That's all coming up on the show today. Speaking of great places to go in Chicago, I talked about The Hideout, Archie's Tavern on the corner of Rockwell and Iowa. It's just a great neighborhood bar, and this is in the Ukrainian Village neighborhood. And it's been there since 1943. And if you have been to Archie's or if you know the area, they have this just phenomenal hams sign that hangs out in front of the bar. And it's kind of, you know, well known in the neighborhood, the beautiful hams, the blue and the red letters and the white background. And the neighborhood folks, sometimes it lights their way home because it's pretty bright. There was a story in Block Club Chicago, Quinn Myers reported this, that the sign, the ham sign, the legendary ham sign, is gone. They had to take it down. The bar, Archie's, had to take it down. Apparently, they've been going back and forth with the city of Chicago about hanging signs outside of the bar since 2017. And when the family that owns the bar went to renew the liquor license this month, they were told that the city would put a hold on the renewal unless that ham sign came down. Well, that's not good. So they took the ham sign down. So they say it's temporary, but I got to think, you know, if you're the city of Chicago, don't you have other things that maybe we should worry about and are a little bit more pressing than trying to kind of go all in and really regulate this family-owned bar in the Ukrainian Village that so many people love to go to? It's a great joint. It's a great spot. I guess there has to be a permit for an establishment to hang a sign outside of it. So the bar is working on that. And as Quinn Myers reports, he actually tweeted this. He said, putting aside the issue at hand here for a second, meaning the sign, one incredible thing I learned while reporting this was that Archie's is the top seller of 12-ounce hams cans in the entire U.S., The bar sold around 50,000 in both 2018 and 2019 and is almost at 40,000 this year. That's a lot of hams. Wow. 40,000 this year, 50K in both 2018 and 2019. We're number one in the United States. If you want to get your hams, go to Archie's. They got you covered. All right, well, hopefully Archie's gets its sign back. Maybe you're having a hams right now. Hey, I get it. No judgment. Family's in town. Stressful times. You got to go back to the fridge, get the leftovers, and don't forget to reheat the mashed potatoes and gravy. The Hideout has been a mainstay in the local music scene for years. Located in the West Town community, tucked away in a pretty industrial area of Chicago, this intimate venue has been a destination for music fans and artists of all genres. On October 19th of this year, Chicago rapper, poet, and artist, and Hideout talent booker, who is an African-American, Mikel DeVille, posted on Instagram that he had been let go as a Hideout employee. He went on to accuse the venue of having a toxic work environment and exploiting his race. The Hideout responded by announcing that effective November 7th, the venue would close down for the rest of the year with, quote, new leadership and a commitment to a healthy, supportive, and respectful organizational culture, end quote. Local journalist and editor of Streets Blog Chicago, John Greenfield, wrote a piece about this issue where he tried to piece together what happened that resulted in the Hideout's closing. And he received some positive feedback and he received a lot of criticism. He is here with us today. John, welcome back to Outside the Loop.
Thanks for having me.
You and I have been talking on the radio here for many, many years about a variety of issues over the years. And so just a couple of things let's establish up front. We are two white guys that have never had to experience anti-black racism. We've not been on the receiving end of that, so we should just acknowledge that. Also, people who are, you know, making allegations about this, I think we should give them the benefit of the doubt, and this is very serious when these allegations come out, for sure. And we're just trying to get maybe a more complete picture here. So you self-published this piece, this lengthy piece. Tell us what you were trying to do here with this piece.
Well, you know, when the Instagram post first came out, you know, my first reaction was that the allegations were troubling. So Mikel DeVille, he was hired by the Hideout in summer of 2021 in the wake of the George Floyd protests and as the pandemic was waning. The Hideout was interested in booking more diverse performers and also you know, their staff has traditionally not been that diverse. So I think they were interested in having a black person in a position of relative power there. You know, they were trying to do the right thing. The owners, who have a good track record for supporting social justice issues, were kind of like trying to figure out what the next step would be to make the Hideout an even better venue. You know, it's a venue that has traditionally specialized in predominantly white genres, alternative country and indie rock, but they've also done a lot of outside the box bookings. They've had a lot of R&B and jazz and soul artists. Hannibal Buress, the comedian, even got his start, you know, once some of his early shows were there. You know, the Hideout was already doing good stuff, but they wanted to take it to the next level. Unfortunately, things didn't work out with DeVille. He was let go in March of 2022. And then on October 19th, he released his Instagram post, basically making allegations that it was an abusive work environment and that he felt he was exploited due to race. And, you know, it was interesting to see what happened in the wake of that. I think everybody was concerned when they heard about that. You know, I thought that the Instagram post really raised a lot of questions, and it was a little bit confusing about exactly what had happened. And, you know, so I just sort of, what I wanted to see happen when the Instagram post came out, and I should disclose that, like, I've been going to the Hideout for decades. I've played shows at the Hideout. I'm acquaintances with the owners, to the co-owners, Tim and Katie Tutton. I'm not like close friends with them or anything, but so I just kind of wanted to see like more light shed on this issue. I know that friends of mine had shows booked at the Hideout, and they were trying to make up their minds about whether they should follow through and play the shows or not, like whether that would be an ethical thing to do in light of the allegations. And it just seemed like there needed to be more information out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, the news articles that came out were mostly pretty much just sharing the statement that DeVille put out there. And then the Hideout put out some very anodyne, inoffensive statements, basically saying, you know, we're sorry to hear that our ex-employee is feeling pain because of his experience at the hideout. We want to find out more about his concerns. We're willing to do a restorative justice process with him. They didn't actually admit that they had done anything wrong. And, you know, because of HR laws, they couldn't really speak very frankly about what had happened. But there was a little bit of a clue that the hideout owners didn't necessarily see his allegations as legitimate, or at least, you know, in terms of the facts of what happened, not the way he was feeling. I mean, you know, if he feels that he experienced racism, nobody can tell him he's wrong, at least certainly not white people or non-black people. But, you know, one of the owners of the hideout, Katie Tutton, said something to the effect of, like, we have a different perspective on his concerns. Something effective like, we don't really see what happened the same way he sees it. So that got me wondering if there was more to the story.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, John, because there are a lot of really good music journalists and people who cover this beat in Chicago. And to get maybe to the root of this, like you say, articles came out and they were sharing the statement, or they were sharing kind of what everyone was seeing, but to kind of go in deeper and investigate what was going on inside the hideout and what was that culture like, for good or for ill, I didn't see really that happening. Is that one of the reasons why you kind of came around with what you wrote ultimately?
Yeah. I mean, there were plenty of articles that didn't do anything wrong. I mean, it was frustrating that they didn't really like tell us anything we didn't already know in terms of the statements that had been released. They're basically just rehashing the statements. You know, I was freelancing the Chicago Reader at the time, and they put out an op-ed that I thought was kind of problematic, where they stated, without citing any additional evidence besides the Instagram post, that the hideout was guilty of failure in how it treated DeVille, and suggested that the hideout harms its employees. And the writer who wrote that acknowledged that he's a big fan of DeVille's, he likes him. And he was actually working on a story about DeVille getting fired, but then DeVille asked him to stop writing the story, so he stopped. And so the Reader got a lot of pushback to that. I was freelancing for them at the time, and I actually said I didn't really think that was a proper way to write a story about this. And the editor of that piece wrote a note following it, a long note, you know, basically acknowledging that there was a tone problem, that it sort of appeared like they'd taken sides on the issue without citing other evidence. And then just I saw other journalists basically making statements on social medias, you know, saying that the hideout was guilty of what they were accused of without providing any other evidence except the Instagram post. So that's kind of why I felt like somebody needed to do a deeper dive into this issue.
Yeah, I mean, so just to be clear about this, what this means, so not only does the hideout close, but the people that work there, right, the people that were, you know, bouncing and working the bar and doing all the jobs that one does in a very small venue like that, which is really everything, those people are out of work for the time being. So this is also affecting other people's livelihoods. And that's something else that we have to keep in mind here. Not only is this venue shuttered for a while, but people are going without a job here. And it's almost like what you were saying, the conversation, at least online, and I know that the online conversation is not exactly nuanced, but it was almost like there was the assumption of guilt before everything sort of came out. And again, maybe there is something going on there, but we just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what kind of troubled me, is just everyone was operating on the assumption that the allegations against the hideout were necessarily true just because one person had made them, and it would be wrong to second guess his allegations. But there's the saying, believe survivors, you know, that you shouldn't second guess it when people make allegations. I mean, I think the healthiest way to view this stuff is like, we should not assume that the allegations are untrue, but I think it's also legitimate to investigate the allegations and see whether there might be more to the story. I mean, you know, for example, like when Joe Biden was running for president, there was a woman who had accused him of sexual abuse or sexual assault. And, you know, of course we should have taken her allegations seriously, but then people did some more digging and they found that, you know, she just had a long line of people that she had screwed over landlords, people she had worked for. You know, she just was not a very reliable source. And I'm not saying that's a parallel situation to what's going on with the hideout, but it just sort of like my point of view is that we shouldn't stop investigating allegations simply because the person making the allegations is asking us not to investigate them. I should also say another really important thing about this situation is, like, DeVille is not talking to reporters. He has said, like, this is my story. I want to tell it the way I want. So I'm not speaking with the press. So, you know, that combined with the fact that HR laws keep the hideout owners from speaking candidly about what happened, like, it's kind of a frustrating situation. So what I did was, you know, I made an attempt to do this. It was challenging because nobody wanted to speak on the record.
Right. And that was one of the, you know, the criticisms here. Let's just talk about this, John, because what you wrote, you have a lot of quotes, but those quotes are not attributed to people. You don't release their names. You tell their racial identity. That, again, I think upset a lot of people when they saw that. Was that in your mind as you wrote this? Because as you were saying, I mean, people aren't necessarily willing to go on record for this. But on the other hand, it's like, well, I need some sources here. I need to attribute these quotes to somebody. Was that in your mind as you put this together?
Yeah. I mean, I consulted with a lot of different peer journalists, a lot of people who had the same perspective on this issue as me, and kind of like, you know, I ran drafts of the article by various people and just asked them, does it seem reasonable what I'm doing here, running a bunch of unattributed quotes? And they all seemed to think that it was a fair way to do it. It's obviously not the ideal way to do it. So just to give you an idea of my MO on writing this article, the way I started out, you know, some people told me, like, it's not appropriate for a white person to write this article. So the first way I attempted to do this was I asked a black colleague if they were interested in writing the main piece, and I would just do the research. They didn't want to get embroiled in the controversy, although they encouraged me to write the piece. What I initially tried to do is I sent a survey to all the hideout employees through someone I know who works there. And I just asked them to, like, respond to all the allegations in DeVille's Instagram post and get back to me. Ultimately, those people generally weren't comfortable participating in that. You know, they thought it over, but they didn't do it. I was able to talk to one hideout employee who talked to me at length. I talked to some very close friends of the bar, talked to a musician who performed there, and later got a statement from a person who booked a monthly series there. And, you know, certain themes came out that, like, I'm convinced that this stuff is probably true because so many people have told me the same thing independently. So, you know, I don't want to go, like, too much into the nitty gritty here. People can read my article if they want to.
Right.
It's, pinned to my Twitter account, which is at Greenfield John, J-O-H-N. And, but, you know, the basic theme was, like, the firing of DeVille seems to have been justified in terms of his work performance. And, you know, the allegation that DeVille referred to in his Instagram post that the hideout leadership said that he had been making disparaging remarks about the club, you know, that seems to be true. I've heard that, you know, multiple people told me that he had issues with booking more than one act during the same time slot. So there were conflicts, or not booking acts on certain nights when bartenders were expecting to make money, not posting ticket links, not advertising the shows. You know, all these things that just, like, are the basic tasks of being a booker. But anyway, you know, I would encourage people that, if you want to know more context about the allegations, to check out my piece. You know, if people don't think it's legitimate because the quotes aren't attributed, I understand that. But I can tell you this is what people told me. I've been a journalist in Chicago for almost a quarter of a century, so, like, I hope people will trust that I'm not fabricating stuff. I kind of stuck out my neck to write this. I've gotten a lot of backlash. I just really didn't like the idea that one person's Instagram post with no corroboration could just, like, you know, shut down people's jobs, shut down a club, damage the reputations of people who I feel have built up a lot of goodwill in the city. And I've talked to a lot of journalists about this situation since then. And like, I've definitely heard from a lot of people who reassured me that I did this properly and that they're glad I wrote the piece. I did, you know, some veteran journalists, including music journalists, kind of told me that it is kind of an impossible situation to write about, though, that if no one, you know, if you've just got statements, no one's willing to go on the record, like, that is a real challenge. So it's just a matter of, like, how do you coax people in going on the record?
It's, you know, the society that we're living in right now, it's almost, you know, when you say one person's accusation and shouldn't shut down the whole operation, or maybe we should look into this more. That's kind of where we're at, where, you know, especially with social media, someone can say something and the reaction is just so knee-jerk. It's just like, oh my God, shut it all down. As you're saying here, maybe we should take another look at things. And I know that your piece, like I said before, it resulted in a lot of criticism. When something like this comes out, what should the role of the press and journalists be? How should we react when an allegation like this surfaces? I mean, is it we immediately, hey, call for the shutdown of whatever the thing is or the canceling of that? Or do we try to foster that conversation? You're going through this right now. What's your perspective?
I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of a the whole concept that if someone accuses an institution of race, of racism, or people of racism, that like it's pretty hard to defend yourself against that allegation. Like with the Hideout, what they're choosing to do, they shut down for the rest of the year. Basically, they had no choice because everyone was boycotting their shows or performers were canceling their shows. And so what they're doing, again, they haven't admitted any wrongdoing, but they basically said, you know, there's always room for improvement, and they're going to work with a diversity, equity, and inclusion firm. I believe they say they're going to get new leadership. I don't know if that means they're going to be firing their manager and or Katie Tutton, the co-owner who was most involved in running the place. But, you know, basically they didn't try to fight the allegations at all, even though what I found out seems to suggest that there is a lot of mitigating information, that like the notion that you would get from the Instagram post that this was just like DeVille was treated horribly and that his bosses were monsters, it just doesn't really seem to hold water when you find out the background information that I found out. So, I mean, again, I want to say, like, I'm not saying that his allegations are completely illegitimate and nobody can tell this guy, like, he's wrong, that he experienced racism, but there really is more to the story. And I just wish more people would be willing to go on the record to say that. But, you know, one silver lining to the story is a GoFundMe was launched to help financially support the Hideout staff who've been laid off because of this. This was something like I was calling for weeks ago. I was saying it'd be really great if someone launched this. So, you know, I think regardless of where you stand on the controversy, I think everybody can agree that the workers are basically just innocent bystanders in this, and they really do deserve support. So it'd be good if people who are moved by the story of what happened in the Hideout can help out the workers, regardless of how you feel about the owners.
What do you hope are the next steps here, or are there any next steps? I mean, the Hideout says it's shut down for the rest of the year. They're working to better themselves. But you've got this piece out there, and we'll link up to it all on our channels through Outside the Loop. But what do you want the next step to be here? Do we even know going forward?
I mean, I would really like, and sort of one of the purposes of writing my piece was like, I was hoping that if I provided enough clues about what was going on via unattributed quotes, some other journalists would take up the story. And, you know, if someone from the Tribune or the Sun-Times was to talk to the same people, maybe they could convince them to go on the record. There's probably going to be some more coverage of the story now that this GoFundMe has launched. So I expect we'll see something on Block Club, maybe some of the other outlets, Block Club Chicago. So I don't know. Maybe this is the end of the story, that there's just like, I wrote this one piece and nobody else is going to be able to do any further digging on this. But either way, I really do hope the Hideout reopens, because I thought it was an important cultural institution, and they did a lot of good in Chicago. Mm.
Well, we can read your piece. Like I said, we will link up to it on OutsideTheLoopRadio.com, WGNRadio.com, and people can decide for themselves. John Greenfield is a local journalist, the editor also of Streets Blog Chicago, chi.streetsblog.org is that website. Hey, John, I appreciate you talking to us today about this. I know this has been kind of a whirlwind of controversy, but look, these are important topics, especially when we talk about inclusion, diversity, and race in Chicago and beyond. And, you know, thinking about trying to be better, but also trying to get to the truth of what happens in our society. And I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks for having me.
It's that time of year again. Yesterday, on Black Friday, this year's lineup of Chicago's Goose Island's Bourbon County Stout line was released to the public. Were you one of those people waiting in line to pick some up? Well, as Josh Noel writes, maybe you should have been, because you might want to make an effort to enjoy this year's batch. Josh is a reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Online at chicagotribune.com, he writes all about the local beer scene. He's also the author of the book Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out, and he is here with us again here on Outside the Loop. Josh, what's up, man?
Hey, Mike. Always glad to chat with you and to chat Bourbon County.
You got it. So really briefly here, you and I have talked about this over the years. Every time around this time, Black Friday is when this Bourbon County Stout line is released for the year. Very quickly here, if we don't know what Bourbon County Stout is or barrel-aged beer, what's the elevator pitch? How do you educate us quickly here?
It is one of the most important beers in the history of craft beer, which sounds like I'm being a little over the top, but actually that is true. So Goose Island first did this in the mid-90s, aged an imperial stout in a used bourbon barrel. Which extracted flavor from the wood, from the oak, the charred oak, and the whiskey that had been in there, and took this imperial stout and created this new thing, which was an imperial stout aged in a whiskey barrel. So it took on all these really fascinating characteristics beyond just the beer. And it became this little experiment at Goose Island Brew Pub in the 1990s became a hallmark of craft brewing. And now there's nearly 10,000 breweries in the country. There were about 1,000 or 1,500 when Goose first did this. And it's something that a lot of breweries do now. If you want to be an ambitious brewery, you probably are aging a stout in a bourbon barrel. And it all started right there at Goose Island. And they still release these beers. It's now become a family of beers every year on the day after Thanksgiving.
Yep. So Goose Island really pioneered this. And hey, this is a big celebration, kind of. Yes, but no. I mean, Goose Island is saying this is the 30th anniversary of Bourbon County Stout, but as you write, that's really not the case. It's more like the 27th anniversary.
Yes, that is right, Mike. Goose Island was never, in reality, completely sure when it first made Bourbon County Stout. It's a longtime brewmaster, Greg Hall, guesstimated 1992, but in later years admitted that that was a guesstimate. And then when I was reporting for my book about Goose Island and its sale to Anheuser-Busch, the more conversations I had and the more dots I connected, it was just clear that it couldn't have been 92. It almost certainly was 95. But Goose Island is sticking to its story. So, you know, I guess that is its right. And so they're celebrating what they call the 30th anniversary of Bourbon County Stout, though it's almost certainly the 27th anniversary.
But hey, who's counting, right? Because this stuff is so good, especially this year. And by the way, I say especially this year because each year these beers, this family of beers that are released, they can be a little different. And as you have said, some years everything is just right on. And in other years, you know, you've got some duds, you've got some really good ones, but I guess that's all kind of part of the fun, isn't it?
Well, the duds aren't fun, especially if you've paid a lot of money for them.
Oh, that's true.
I typically I get samples from the brewery, or I have an expense account at the Tribune that allows me to, you know, be immune from the financial pangs of a bad bourbon county. So it is disappointing, I think, to people when they open one and don't really care for it. But and the Bourbon County program has really been sort of up and down in recent years. Every year there's something's going to be good, but then there's a question of sort of where the drop off is after that and how far it goes. Mm-hmm. And some years the drop off is quick and goes deep, but this year, the drop off is pretty small and really the whole lineup is pretty solid.
Yeah. Let's talk about this year's Goose Island Bourbon County Stout lineup. So there's two kind of the big boys here that we're going to just highlight. So the first is the Bourbon County 30th Anniversary Reserve Stout. And as you write here in your piece up at ChicagoTribune.com, we always like to say, oh, the beer is so smooth. But really, this is a beer that's smooth, and it's coming in at 14.4% ABV. So this is a big boy.
It is a big boy. But yeah, I make the point that people, it's funny how often people use the word smooth to describe beer, and it's really not a very descriptive word for uh-huh. beer. But what people are just trying to say is that it's approachable and accessible. But yeah, no, funny enough is I cracked open this Reserve Anniversary Stout and I thought, oh man, that's one smooth beer. But really it's a really just lovely barrel aged stout. It's not flashy. It's not trying to do a whole lot. It's just this really lovely blend of this Imperial Stout aged in bourbon barrels from four different Jim Beam brands.
Hmm.
And it just blends into this really lovely whole that is very, yes, smooth and approachable. And it doesn't really flex its muscle in the alcohol. But it's there. I mean, it's a weighty beer, but it's just so lovely and dialed in and has really nice and interesting flavors. And it's really Goose Island, really, even if it is the 27th anniversary, they really honored the 30th anniversary quite nicely with this beer.
Well, how about that? And the other one here that stands out, the Bourbon County 2-Year Barley Wine Reserve. This is coming in at 17% ABV. Hello. But this was another one.
Yeah, this is the other big ticket item from this year's lineup. It's really sort of the polar opposite of the stout. The stout is very sort of elegant and smooth and just really nicely threaded. This is a big, burly, gnarly, muscular beer. I mean, the barrel that the beer was aged in is really on display, old Fitzgerald bourbon barrels. And it's a big bad beer. It's one that I really admired and enjoyed for about 4 or 5 sips. And then after that, I was sort of, I got it and was ready to move on.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty neat thing they achieved there. Definitely one to share with some people.
Yeah, that's the other thing. These are probably the two most expensive out of the entire line, right? They're coming in at about $40. Is that right?
Well, that's the recommended price. And at some retailers, you're going to see it for probably more than that. And at some retailers, you'll probably see it for twice that. Because those are every year Bourbon County has some beers people really want. And then there are some Bourbon County beers people are really not that interested in which you'll find marked down at your local grocery store in 8 months to some shockingly low price. But these two are not those beers. These beers will have value. People will want them. And they're really nicely built.
And the entire line's good. So if you want to read about the entire line, all 7 of these beers, you can go to ChicagoTribune.com. We will also link up to what Josh is writing. Josh, before I let you go, let me ask you this. Is there a particular non-stout holiday beer, winter beer that you are currently enjoying that you can recommend to all of us?
Ooh, I'm actually, you're going to get a little sneak peek here because I'm actually working on a story right now about Christmas beers that'll probably publish maybe in the coming days. So I've actually been drinking through those. I can mention two. One is from Bell's Brewery, good old Bell's in Michigan.
Sure.
People know that. Two Hearted, Oberon, you know, those are some of the classic Bell's beers. They have a Christmas ale that comes out every year. It's just a nice Scotch ale. It's about 8% alcohol, something like that. And there's no funky spices or seasonings like a lot of Christmas beers do. It's just a really nice, lovely, warming beer. So respect to Bell's for their Christmas ale. I drank through a bunch, and I hadn't had that beer in years and years, and I wasn't sure what to expect. And mm-hmm. It's just a nice thing to have in your fridge. And then the other thing, which is the polar opposite, is Southern Tier has a beer called the number two X MAS, so like kind of double Christmas or two Xmas, however you want to say it. And this thing is just full of spices and all sorts of crazy Christmas flavors. I can't even, off the top of my head, it's like, you know, cinnamon and clove and fig and all that kind of stuff. It smells to me like a pine cone that's been doused in potpourri. But
yeah,
it's really tasty. They did a really nice job with it. All those crazy flavors are just balanced and integrated really nicely. So if you want a really fun, kind of over the top, but nicely done Christmas beer, then that Southern Tier 2 Xmas is the pick here.
All right, there you go. Josh Noel, he is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covers the local beer scene, and he is also the author of the book Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out. He literally wrote the book on the history of Bourbon County Stout when it comes to Goose Island and looking at those barrel-aged beers. Hey, Josh, like I always say, you've got the greatest job ever, and happy holidays, man. Thanks for giving us some time today, and, you know, bottoms up.
Yeah, happy holidays to you and yours. I hope you drink well and eat well and enjoy, and, yeah, let's have a good 2023, shall we?
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 841 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer in the studio today. A reminder that if you don't subscribe to the podcast of this show, go ahead and make it a part of your weekly routine. You can subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You can still stream it, of course, but when you subscribe, everything just gets magically delivered to your device. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.